The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday afternoon Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. That's not me coughing for a change. I'm getting a break from it. So that's Robert over there in the UK. Yeah, don't put that one on me. So far, no coughing for me today. Maybe the bronchitis has finally taken a hike. But we are doing the Monday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. And thank you very much for tuning in. And Robert Walker is our guest. I'll introduce him again in just a minute. He's always a great guest, and I look forward to very good discussion on many important topics with Robert. But we appreciate your signing in and listening to our program. So for those of you who would like to call Robert, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring and we'll answer it and get you up on air as quickly as possible. And also remember, patience is a virtue, as is being succinct in your emails and comments. So again, 1-866-687-7223. You can also email us at drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. And you can post comments on our blog. To do that, go to our homepage, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right side, and that is upcoming shows. Robert's show is the first one listed. Open it up. That is our archive page for this program. And then comments are down at the bottom. You do not have to be logged in to your account to post a comment. Just post away, and as soon as I get it out, integrate it into our discussion for today. Our Space Show website newsletter for the week is posted. It was put up early yesterday evening after the Sunday Space Show program. So do check it out. It gives you all the details of the programs for this week. Plus, if you scroll down, you'll see all of our programming that is planned and already set with firm dates. So that'll give you an idea of what's ahead on the Space Show. We are booking through the third quarter of 2017 already. Boy, that just seems to be impossible, and time is going way, way too fast. Everything we do is archived, so you can very quickly listen off of our website or download these programs. A 90-minute program is maybe 11 or 12 megabytes. If you need it emailed to you for some reason or another, don't hesitate to ask. There's a menu on the upper left of our homepage, thespaceshow.com, and under support, you will find our logo wear store, where you can get T-shirts, coffee mugs, hats, license plate frames, things of that nature. And then in addition, there is another menu item called Listen Live, and this tells you how to listen to a live Space Show program or an archive program. And then center right on our homepage is, to me, the most important, because that is support the Space Show. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit in the United States, and we are able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially contribute to and support the Space Show. As a nonprofit, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're paying California taxes, since we're a California public benefit corporation, you also get a tax deduction for your state of California taxes. We could not be doing this program without your support and your contributions. I cannot overstate that, and nor can I overstate the importance of that. So if you like the Space Show, you like our guests, you like the format, you like the fact that the content is all for free, help us out and do support us and keep the Space Show going. And we say thank you to all of you who do that and to all of you who will be doing that. Visit OneGiantLeapFoundation.org for information. That is our parent nonprofit. Or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember we are copyrighted and trademarked. All of you have permission to download our programs and share them with others. There's a couple of rules on that, though. Don't do anything commercial with any of our programs. Do not edit, clip, cut, or place anything of our shows on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Please do read our full copyright statement at the bottom of every one of the Space Show website pages, as well as OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website pages. If you have any questions or any special needs, please don't hesitate to email me about it, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're in iTunes as well, and if you have podcasting comments or questions, I'll do my very, very best to respond to you and to resolve your issues. And we do have corporate sponsors, and you can see their banner ads flying at supersonic speed across our homepage. So do take time and pause them every once in a while to read them and see what their messages are. We would not be doing this show without our corporate sponsors either. So they are a very, very important part of our Space Show support family and network. We do have a couple of sponsors for the first segment of this program. So, as always, the Integrated Space Plan is a first segment sponsor, and they have the detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space. Their plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. You can see it at thespaceplan.com. And then if you view the plan online, all of those little cells in the plan that you will see, if you check it out, you'll know what I'm talking about. Well, you can open them up and massage them for more information. However, you can buy a copy of the Integrated Space Plan poster. It is not interactive, but it is way, way cool. And I have the large size. It's sitting on the door to my radio studio. It's very inspiring. I'm sure it will be inspiring for you, too. And again, you can purchase that and get more information at thespaceplan.com. For those of you going to ISDC in St. Louis later in May, they are rolling out a new revised space plan. There's a big to-do about it, so look on your programming when you get to ISDC and make sure you attend their events and check it out, and then report back to the Space Show. Tell us what you think of it all, okay? Also, the Space Foundation is a sponsor. They just completed the 33rd Space Symposium. I've been talking about that a lot on air since I got back from Colorado Springs. Their 34th symposium is just around the corner, and even though it's a year away, it will go by very, very quickly. So it is just around the corner. April 16th to the 19th, 2018, Colorado Springs, Colorado, again at the Broadmoor. So this is a great place for networking and for meeting people and seeing a different type of space and getting involved in cyber and DOD activities and other activities. You really need to attend it. So, again, the 34th symposium just around the corner, April 16th to the 19th, 2018. And you can go to the spacefoundation.org website and get a lot more information. So as I said a few minutes ago, Robert Walker is back with us from the United Kingdom. He is an inventor and a programmer and an author, and he has been on the Space Show many, many times. And sometimes he's controversial, like his planetary protection idea. He is a champion blogger on our blog. I think, Robert, you may lead the pack in driving blog comments and technical comments on different issues that get discussed on your programs as well as other Space Show programs. Robert's full bio is on the website. You can read about it. His website is science20.com. And over on the left side, if you go there, that's the generic address for it. You'll see, I think, a label for technology or science or something like that. And scroll down and you'll see space. And Robert posts his comments there in the space category. He actually has an article that triggered me to invite him back to this show, though he does have some new books that are published. And he has a lot of other work that we will talk about today. But March, he wrote an article, March 14th, why I wouldn't fly with SpaceX to the moon as soon as 2018 if they paid me $1 billion. So I thought that was worthy of Robert coming back on the space show and telling us why he wouldn't take $1 billion to go to the moon with SpaceX next year. I would take $1 billion from him, Robert. I'm claustrophobic as hell. It might be a hard trip for me. This assumes that the vehicle doesn't blow up or something like that, and then it wouldn't make any difference. But I'd probably take the risk for $1 billion, but you wouldn't do it, huh?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, actually, on the claustrophobia thing, Ben, I used to think, I'd be far too claustrophobic in the rocket, but until I tried out my nephew has the HD5, and I tried out trying the Apollo 11 flying up into space, and somehow even just a tiny, tiny window in this 3D thing and looking out, but seeing the vastness of space outside, then I think perhaps the claustrophobia wouldn't be such an issue as you might think. Something up, but it makes quite a difference. But, I wouldn't go. I wouldn't go in 2018. No, no way. Just no way. Not at all. And
well, would you do it because of safety, or you don't want to go to the moon, or you don't like SpaceX, or what would be your top reasons for rejecting $1 billion?
Well, it would be the safety of the mission, and also think that this is the wrong way for a human spaceflight to go, and I don't want to support it by going on it, and I don't want to support a dangerous mission. I don't want to be on a dangerous mission like that, where all the way through you're aware that if they had just done a little bit more testing before, then it could be so much more safer. And that really is the main thing, is that they've got this wonderful approach which could make their, could compensate. They have been much criticized for various aspects of the way that they're planning to do human spaceflight. But they have this wonderful approach that they can send the Dragon, and each time they do their test flight, they're actually getting paid for it. So it's very unlike, for instance, the SLS, where they're losing money every time. So they're paying out money. But the SpaceX are actually gaining money every time they do a test flight. But they're just losing all that by doing this, if they did follow this plan. However, I think you need to take it a little bit of a pinch of salt, because Elon Musk does these rousing speeches to energize his fan base. So I wouldn't, and how it's been with the Falcon Heavy, I wouldn't be surprised if it actually flies in the mid-2020s. We don't know what it's actually going to be like with human flight, but I think he may turn out being much more safety conscious than he seems to at the moment. But see, the problem is really this narrative that he's putting forward, which is the narrative that NASA is just being too safety conscious, and that everyone else is being too safety conscious, and NASA and SpaceX are going to be the brave ones going ahead, going through the frontier and doing dangerous things. And that, I say, is just not, first of all, that's not the problem with NASA. NASA is not too safety conscious, and this is most decidedly not the right way to send humans into space. We have the dice load against us enough anyway. We want to do everything to put the dice in our favor, load the dice in our favor when going into space. And if it takes two or three extra missions, to do it safely. And I think you can say quite fairly that with Apollo 8, that NASA did not do one too few missions. They did just the right number to have a good chance of doing it safely. And if they'd missed out one mission before, there's lead up to Apollo 8 and the lead up to Apollo 11. So, of course, some of the precursors were for Apollo 11, but the ones that were necessary for Apollo 8, so the testing of the re-entry at the lunar pad at 11 kilometers per second with Apollo 4, and the Apollo 7 doing a full length of the life support, then going to the Apollo 8. And then Apollo 8 was not a mission for passengers. It was a mission where not just the space, everything had to be tested, but the human beings on board, they had to be tested as well. They had to be people who were like test pilots, would be cool in a crisis. They'd be able to do everything. They wouldn't have wanted payload of passengers who would panic and wouldn't know what they're doing and be continuing saying. So I am not a test pilot. So I don't know how I would react on this mission if some huge disaster suddenly came up and everybody's going around coolly doing everything. I'd be saying, what's going on? You know, have you solved it yet? You know, all this sort of thing. And, I would not be a good person to be on it. If it was So there's the question of whether there would be passengers on board is one thing, and in whether it's all right even for test pilots. So even for test pilots, the multiple reasons why this is far too rapid, I think, even for test pilots. It's much, much faster than Apollo 8. And I've got a quote here in my article by, who is it? There's one here from Wayne Hall, former manager of Space Shuttle Program. And he's quoted by Space.com saying, even with today's technology, it's still an extraordinarily difficult, extraordinarily dangerous task to undertake, period. I don't care who you are. And that's what I feel about it. We haven't done it since then. And so it's not, and it's nothing to do with NASA being too safety conscious. Because if the president were to say to NASA, go back to the moon, or if the American government would, then they would go and do it again. The only reason they're going back and forth to the ISS over and over again is because that's what the government has told them to do, and they don't have any choice in the matter. Now, you can ask, you know, how much this is dialogue between high-ups in NASA and the government, but in final analysis, it's the president that's telling them to this. So I think that this analysis way out is we do not need to go dangerous in space. I would not do anything to encourage it. I would not be the right person to be on that mission. I would feel that they haven't done enough preliminary tests. They do it as rapid as that. Because their plan is to... So the first two would be all right if their rockets were okay. So if the SpaceX rockets were... If there weren't questions about the rockets themselves, then the first two is just the same as what Boeing is going to be doing, that they send an unmanned mission. They do it in I've got the date written down here somewhere. They do it in November of this year, I think, that they would be sending uncrewed, and then May of next year they send a crewed mission with Douglas Hurley and Sunita Williams as the astronauts. And they would be capable of evaluating this and saying, you know, we as test astronauts, we can evaluate this, we look at it, technical details, and we'll decide whether we will take on this risk if they see it as a risk. So on those, as far as that is concerned, then that, apart from there being some questions that I want to talk about using SpaceX rockets at all, but otherwise they're parallel to Boeing, except Boeing have the advantage that they can fly their capsule on, and they're going to go just a little bit later in the year, they can fly their capsule on any rocket they like, and so they're going to fly it on the Atlas V, which has, I think, 70 successes without a failure.
But, Robert, if there's no government money in the flight, why can't I or anyone decide my own level of risk, and if I want to go to Mars or go to the moon or go to Europa, why can't I go? Why does somebody else have to tell me what my safety standard choice has to be? If there's no government money or taxpayer money involved in this, why can't I make my own choice? And why can't SpaceX or whoever is out there sell me a ride if I want to take the risk?
Right. So first of all, if you're talking about me personally, there's obviously nothing that I can actually do about it. You know, so I'm just someone commentating.
No, I understand that, but I'm talking about in theory and principle, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, and so, but there are regulations about this, because if you were back in the early 20th century, maybe, yes, you could do that. But as it is now, then the FAA is going to step in if you're doing something that they reckon to be dangerous. So if you're setting up an airline, you couldn't set up...
Well, no. You're doing apples and oranges here. There are a ton of regulations on the FAA about flying, from airplane structure to all sorts of different things, and that doesn't exist in human spaceflight yet. Well, now, maybe someday it will, but, again, if there's no government money or resources being used, that yes, they still need a launch license to get from the FAA, and we're talking about doing this from the United States, but the rule right now is they need to present the passenger, meaning me in this case, with informed consent, which means I have to do what they have defined informed consent to be, as does the company. But then If I want to take the risk, if I want to do a suicide, stupid, dumb mission, that's my choice to do. And you nor no regulator as of today can stop that unless there's government money or it's a government project or something like that. And what's wrong with that? Why can't individuals make their own choice? Why do you and others have to say, you can't make your own choice? You're not wise enough or smart enough or courageous enough to make your own choice. We have to do that for you, and we have to control this for you. Why do you have to? Why does anyone have to do that for another person?
Right. Well, it's for the same reason. So, first of all, I mean, I was under that same impression, but when I looked into it for this article and I researched into it, there are actually a whole lot of regulations on spaceflight. And the FAA has set out a whole series of milestones.
But not for private spaceflight,
yes,
without government
SpaceX
money.
Yes, SpaceX have to go through a whole series of milestones before they can do these things.
But Robert, that to fly an individual commercially with no private funds. Again, my understanding is that this is governed by the commercial space law that was done in 2014. The vehicle needs to have some kind of approval status from the FAA. Okay, and right now that doesn't exist. We both understand that because
the vehicles don't exist.
And they need informed consent to the passenger, and they need some kind of medical authorization from the passengers, or they're called spaceflight participant's physician. And then that's it for commercial spaceflight as of today. Now, that could change.
There's more to it than that. SpaceX has been mandated to do all sorts of things.
For government space flights, for carrying astronauts to and from the space station, and for cargo, they're mandated to do things. The law for carrying space flight participants
is stronger than for the NASA.
You should go do your research and
I've got the link. If you go to my page, there's a link if I can find it.
Well, if you can give it to us real quick, I'll pull it up, because it's informed consent, it's physician's approval, and this is strictly commercial. I'm not talking about any government money or anything, no taxpayer. Once you put taxpayers in the loop, it's a different ballgame. I agree with you. But then again, to me, if I want to go climb Mount Everest, or the one I use all the time on the show is scuba diving with sharks, which I used to do when I was young. The government's not telling me that's too risky. Yeah. So why are they telling me it's too risky if I want to go to Mars, assuming there's a way to go to Mars? I mean, obviously
there's
not.
I've got the links in the article. If you go down to FAA regulations, and then you go down to link to their 2006 regulations, then that's where you can read all about it.
Well, I think that... I haven't read your regulations and what you put, and I've got the paper in front of me.
It refers to passengers. What do they call them? In FAA notes, someone paying to fly, whether it's a passenger or at the controls, is a spaceflight participant.
Right. We've talked about that. And why do they? Why did they? I mean, this is really an old discussion for the spaceflight. Do you know why they are called spaceflight participants and not passengers?
No.
Well, let me tell you why. Because under law, domestic U.S. law and international air flight law, passenger refers to something very specific in the term. And they did not want to do that because they consider human commercial space flight and space tourism as an experiment. So they made the designation space flight participant because the tourist is actually part of the space flight experiment with the space flight company. They are not legally passengers.
Okay, yes.
So that's why they're called participants. And the regulations for that that participant, they need to have informed consent, and the FAA defines what informed consent is, and they need to have medical approval, and they need to have certified or licensed or some kind of nomenclature vehicle that they're flying on, and that informed consent has to present the safety history of that entire spacecraft vehicle composition, the launcher, the thing you're riding in, all of that. And many say it will have to include the entire human spaceflight industry, because there's just so few flights on any of this stuff that to give you the history of one flight or no flight is kind of irrelevant. So they would have to give you sort of the whole spaceflight, human spaceflight, you know, history. But that's it for commercial spaceflight participants.
Well, these regulations actually say more than that. They say, for instance, that that if you are paying to fly and you're not employed by the company, then you may not take part in an envelope expansion flight.
Well, you can fly to the moon.
You're not allowed to pilot it.
Yeah, but you can fly to the moon. You can fly, you know, as a tourist, and that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about these guys, you know, commanding the spacecraft. We're not talking about them being the pilot, even on Blue Origin, where they, you know, it's flown computer-wise without pilots.
Yeah.
The spaceflight participants going up on the ride, they're not taking control of the vehicle and being able to fly it. They can't even do it in an emergency.
Yes.
You know, I'm just saying in theory, many people, myself included, and I, by the way, I have no desire to ride to the space. I couldn't afford it, and two, I value my kids and my family, and I'm probably a little bit too risk averse. But I think that people ought to be able to take risk if they want to take it, and I don't think government should determine what level or what controls on risk there were. I'm kind of in the boat where Rand Sinberg is on this. I think we're too risk averse. Now, if you're doing government money and taxpayer money and taking you know, people to the ISS and stuff like that, and they want to control safety and things of that nature, then I don't have any problem with that. And then that raises another question for me, because the company would be suicidal in business, if you ask me, Robert, if they had one set of safety standards for taking NASA and ESA astronauts to the space station and another set of really lackadaisical safety standards.
Yeah, exactly.
But that would just be commercial nonsense and suicide. It wouldn't be regulatory. It would just be, how stupid can you be to have one set of no regulations here and another set saying this is, you have to be safe over here? That doesn't make sense for a commercial company. So obviously they would go with the regulated safety standards of going to the space station.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we just have to. I looked at the regulations clearly, and it seems pretty clear to me that the regulations on the spaceflight participants were actually stronger than on the test flights and the test pilots, and that on the test pilots there were quite strong conditions. The idea was, as I understood it, is, and they actually explained it, that the reason for having these regulations on the passengers was to protect the passengers, because the test pilots, they can have inside understanding of the company, they know secrets, things that can't be, and they can understand the machinery and everything. They can evaluate risk, and they say that the passengers don't have that, so they need stronger protection. That's what it actually says in this document. Now, I mean, maybe other people listening know more about it.
Let's see what listeners say and post on the blog, because I think you're overstating the case for the commercial aspect of this.
Well,
but again, a company would be. I think a company would be really, really stupid to have a set of very easy, lackadaisical, non-safety standards for you and me who want to go take a joyride around the moon, and then say, oh, but if we're going to fly NASA people or ESA people to the space station, here you got to comply with this, this, and this to make it really safe. I think that is commercial suicide for a company to have two standards like that.
I think it's commercial suicide also just to have unsafe missions into space.
Well, yeah, it is. So
when there's competing companies that are sending, doing safe missions in space.
Don't you,
has a safety record of 100%.
Don't you trust the companies to know that they need to be safe and not take risk and screw it up?
I don't think this is actually going to happen, because I think that it's not so much saying that I'm thinking that Elon Musk is going to do something dangerous. Is that I think that this is just making a message that's coming over. I don't see how he can. It wouldn't make commercial sense for him to actually do what he's
yeah, but you think it'll be delayed, but so you think it'll be pushed back from 2018?
Yeah, exactly. What I'm saying, what I'm putting in there is that I can't see him doing this before, like maybe the mid-2020s, going around the moon, because it just would make no commercial sense. It'd be too dangerous. And it would just be, he doesn't want to be known as the company that people die on. And, if he starts doing these kind of fun but dangerous things, and he keeps doing them, then he's going to be the company that people die, have quite a high risk of dying. And if he does send these people around the moon in 2018, and then they all die, or if they survive that one, but he keeps on doing it, then at some point it's bound to happen, if they keep doing risky things like this. And then, as soon as that happens, then people will say to him, well, why did you do it? Or even all the fans that have been saying, you're sort of cheering him on. And then he does something like this, and they go and look at it, and they say, well, look, you surely should have known that the life support was going to fail. Why didn't you test it for beforehand in LEO first? Why didn't you test the fast re-entry with an unmanned mission before doing it with humans on board? Why did you send passengers on board when you could have sent test pilots in a situation where they got in the way when there was some dangerous thing that arose? So they will all be very critical of him if an accident happens. And I think he will surely, as a wise CEO, he'll know that.
Robert,
I can't really see it happening.
Okay, you've got a lot of emails and you've got a caller on hold. So
okay.
Let me take them in order. So, caller on hold, you're number three behind two emails. I'm sorry, but I'm going to try to do this in order. So, the first email came from Doug in Southern California, who says, to set the context, what things will have flown by the time this lunar flyby mission would happen? Will an uncrewed Falcon Heavy have flown? Will the Dragon have flown with crew to the ISS? And that's Doug, who's in Southern California.
Okay. So it's my understanding, from what I've read, is that there would be just these two missions before, which is the one end of this year, which would be an unmanned Dragon 2 on a Block 5. The Block 5, of course, hasn't launched yet either, so that's a new rocket. And then next spring, there would be a crewed with the two NASA astronauts on board and a Block 5. And then in the autumn that year, the third mission with crew, and then that would be, it must be a Dragon 2 because it's going around the moon in order to be certified for re-entry to the Earth. And then that surely means that unless the Block 5 has an enormous increase in performance, then that surely has to mean that it's launching on a Falcon Heavy. So I think from reading about various people commenting on it, that is the sequence, and that would then, according to his plan as he sketched it out, that would be the third flight. And so it would be the first manned launch on the Falcon Heavy, and there would have been no tests of this Dragon 2 re-entry, and it's the second crewed mission would have been docked to the ISS, so it is not really a test of life support for the duration of that mission either. So life support wouldn't really have been tested either.
Well, not for a lunar return mission, no.
For the lunar return mission.
Yeah.
So it would have been like doing Apollo 8 without Apollo 4 and without Apollo 7.
Let's take
passengers on board.
I'm going to go to your phone call, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And caller, I apologize for keeping you on hold. So tell us who you are, please, and where you are, and welcome to the Space Show with Robert Walker.
Sure, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Again, I apologize for keeping you on hold, but go for it. You got the microphone.
Sure, it happens. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Kim.
First I wanted to say, did you guys cover the envelope expansion flight? Because when I call in, there's always a gap between what I'm hearing streamed and what I hear live when the phone connects.
I have not covered it with Robert. I don't think he's mentioned it yet.
Yes.
The paragraph under the one that he read, because it's an envelope expansion flight, it's against the rules. Robert can explain more.
Yes, that's right. That the passengers, the space flight participants, so not as Dave just explaining that it's more general than, it's not really strictly passengers, but space flight participants, more general thing, then they are not permitted, if they're not employed or not directly involved on the actual commercial company itself, then they are not permitted to go, to be on an envelope expansion mission at all, according to the FAA rules in the regulations that I read, to the 2006 regulations. So if I understood it properly. So that makes me wonder how it is possible. You know, they would have to say that this is not an envelope expansion flight, and I don't really understand. So, I mean, maybe someone knows more about these regulations than me, but I don't really understand how on this timetable they would actually even be permitted to do it, because how can it not be an envelope expansion flight to be the first flight around the moon and the first re-entry at high speed at 11 kilometers per second from the moon and all these things?
Well, you'd have to see what his launch license application was and how he did it.
Yeah. Yes, well, he hasn't done any of that yet.
Yeah.
No, it's just a plan. He's got it for these first two, then that is, you know, quite likely to go ahead. You know, I mean, they've actually got the dates sort of on the calendar, as it were, already. But this third one is just an idea.
I wish we knew who the people are that are interested doing it, and what percentage of the price they have put down on the ticket. I think that'd be really fascinating to know. What else,
Kim? I was just going to add to what you just said. I think that's a significant unknown factor. We don't know who it is. Just suggested by the mere fact that he wouldn't of course, Elon does say things, and by this time, you can just take for granted everybody knows he says one thing, and the actual timeline is at least three times long. But
Well, he doesn't. That's, from a business perspective, he certainly has no obligation to tell us who the people are, and in fact, that may be a condition of their wanting to do this, is to remain anonymous for the time being. So,
I imagine. But I also would not be surprised at all if there are people who are qualified to take this kind of risk, and that's why they really want to go.
Former astronauts or someone like that, you mean?
Well, I mean, exactly. Former astronauts, it would make a huge difference. Yeah.
Like a retired astronaut or somebody.
Yeah, somebody who wants to make a point. I mean, it's obvious how risky this voyage is, and it wasn't something that was advertised. It was something that someone approached SpaceX specifically because they wanted to do, and damn it, they just want to do it. That makes it seem rather likely to me that this is someone who really knows a lot about what they're getting into.
It would seem to me he wouldn't. The first people that he would want to do this with would not be neophytes who've never done anything like this and don't know what they're talking about. So I would think that if he were really soliciting for this or taking someone seriously for it, they'd be somewhat experienced in spaceflight. I mean, that would just seem rational to me.
But then, on the other hand, it does say that they're going for a year of training beforehand. But then, I mean, I suppose if it was someone of that nature, I mean, so they could still be needing a year of training beforehand, because just to get up on the mission. I mean, I'd say I haven't heard anyone suggesting that before. But if that would, of course, change the whole complexion of it, if it was someone who's already a test pilot, you know, who's actually learned to assess such risks. You know, like, I mean, say it was a test pilot from Virgin Galactica or someone who, but I'm difficult to believe that someone with that kind of training would actually be able to afford something like this. But if there was someone like that, of course, that does change quite a bit of the complexion of the thing. But it still does seem very, very dangerous. As you say, if the FAA approved it, if they're test pilots, if they're doing it like that, there's still the thing that that it would have a huge impact on both personally. And it's this question, why is he doing it so quickly? Because he's squandering what could be a huge advantage. So the thing is that his Falcon, his Block 5, he hasn't yet frozen a rocket, and he's had a failure every a bit more than a dozen every 14 flights for the last couple of years or so. He is building up to doing 40 flights a year or more. So if he were to freeze the Falcon 9 Block 5, and if he is really confident that he can deal with all these, so he's had very experienced astronauts saying that this launch is dangerous. Now, that doesn't mean that they're right, but they are people who you should listen to. And so he, and then just quite categorically saying, we never have anyone near the rocket while it's being fueled. And so, and they're just saying, you just shouldn't do this. So he's obviously, Elon Musk is saying, it is safe, we're going to find a way of doing it safely. Well, with his huge numbers of rockets, which he actually is being paid for each time, we'd only need 2.5 years to have 100 flights of his Block 5. And if he had 100 successful flights in a row with no explosions, then he would then have an excellent record. So why is the rush to do it at a very such an early stage, when just 2.5 years later, he could say to everyone, look, I'm sending passengers into space, and I've got... it doesn't seem that... again, maybe someone could correct me on this, but I'm a bit puzzled by this, because it seems to me, if I understand right, that Boeing and SpaceX, there isn't a kind of race. It's not like the first one to get crew to the ISS will get all the flights to the ISS. And so if it took SpaceX just a little bit longer because the Boeing are launching on a proven rocket that has, been safely for 70 flights, and so they don't have the same issues with their rocket that SpaceX have with it. And you know, things like the Falcon Heavy, if you're going around the moon, the issues of it may be that it's something like the Apollo, the Saturn V Pongering, you know, in some way it's breaking apart on the way up, or the launching with the passengers on putting loading the fuel with the passengers on board. These two things that people have been had some concerns about, and if they were to address that by just doing lots of unmanned flights and proving that it's as safe as the Atlas V, and if which is obviously what they believe it to be, and if they're sending passengers on board, then they must think it's pretty safe. So why don't they just do and? And then if they can prove that it's both lower cost and also that it's not going to explode, then they will have people also help attract lots of unmanned space flight, even more than they are already, and they would be way ahead of the field. So I don't really understand why they're in such a rush to put humans on board this rocket before proving that it is safe, given they have this huge advantage if they were just to pay it. So,
you have another email question from a listener.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you that. This is George in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I think the discussion is missing something because I also believe that while there would be a lot of risk to the people actually riding on this thing to go to the moon, there would be substantial risk for SpaceX, the company, if they had a mishap or a failure, injured or killed the people going or lost the rocket. I suspect that such a magnificent loss, and that is his word, magnificent, loss like this would severely damage the company, and many would be making cases far worse than Robert is making for having done this too soon. So why would SpaceX be so in a hurry to run the risk of possibly taking down the entire company for this type of a mission? At this time, they have not yet launched 20 rockets without a mishap. And the Atlas V has a significantly greater launch success rate than that, although when they started out, they did not have a successful launch rate. They had a lot of problems. So I think in a sense, George in Santa Fe is agreeing with you, but he's pointing out that there's an enormous risk to the company itself, which he doesn't understand why they would want to take on.
Yeah, so that is exactly, that is one of the reasons, because I want SpaceX to succeed. So the reason, one of the reasons why I wouldn't do it if you paid me $1 billion, because I want SpaceX to succeed in sending humans into space. So that is one of my top reasons why I just wouldn't do it.
Kim, are you still with us?
Yes, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be, but
Do you have anything else, or do you want to free up the line?
No, I actually do. Robert made the point about the fuel loading, and SpaceX has backed off from that in their more recent statements because of the accident, and because the accident report is now in, they are planning to load fuel at a warmer temperature, and they certainly have time to change a lot of things, but their architecture before they got to actually launching this.
Ah, are they really? So are they thinking of possibly launching it early then? That of course would make quite a difference. Maybe they're actually listening to the experts then. Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't say how much warmer, but they did specifically mention loading the fuel at a warmer temperature. I don't know what that means in terms of load temperature.
It might be just a little bit warmer rather than loading it. Because the problem at the moment is that they cool it down, they put the fuel through liquid to nitrogen, which has been cooled in cooled to very low temperatures, minus 200 degrees centigrade in a vacuum, and you obviously can't keep that cold inside the rocket. So within a short while, you've got to have the humans on board already, because it's just in time enough to get them on board before the fuel starts warming up. Then that's the end of it. So it might be that I don't know. If it had just a little bit warmer, and it only makes it 8% denser, but it seems that makes a significant difference. So it's supposed to be a question of whether it is just that they want to have it a little bit warmer in order to have not such extreme conditions, so as to be less likely to cause problems, or if they have it significantly warmer in order to be able to load the fuel before the humans. So I'd be interested to know which it is.
You have another email from our space attorney resident advisor for the space show, Michael Listener,
okay,
who says there is a difference between taking a risk and being reckless. The question your guest appears to be wrestling with, I'm adding that because I think he's left out a couple of words in his email.
Mm-hmm.
The question your guest appears to be wrestling with is whether or not launching on a Falcon 9 is risky or reckless. And my hunch is that Michael thinks you believe launching on the Falcon 9 for this would be reckless, not risky.
Yes.
Am I right on that assumption?
Yes, I think so, yes.
So you think it's reckless?
Yes.
Okay. And Michael points out that there is a distinction and difference between taking a risk and being reckless. And I think everybody would agree with you guys on that.
Okay. Okay. Oh, good clarification,
yeah. Legal difference, which is probably why he said it that way.
Say it again. You cut out a little bit, Kim.
Sorry, it's a legal difference, which is probably why he said it that way. Reckless behavior is you're liable for that.
Correct. And but you would have to prove. I mean, if this thing ever happened, and I agree with Robert on this point that the delays will be significant. So this is not going to happen in 2018. But if it did happen, and if all hell broke loose, you would have to prove reckless behavior. It would not be assumed. And I honestly, not being an attorney, would have no clue how easy or difficult it might be to prove reckless behavior. I'll defer to Michael and other brilliant space attorneys to tell us that.
Right.
But I assure you the charges would be made that it would be reckless behavior. And the family members probably would charge it as reckless behavior too.
And I don't think that by personality that Elon Musk is himself reckless. So that's why I'm not...
I agree with you on that.
In his words, it sounds like that. But I'm not sure that personally from his actions that he would be with humans.
No, I agree with you on that. I think there's a big difference in Elon Musk public relations and statements he makes and interviews he makes from the reality of how he runs his business.
Because
he runs his business really, really well and professional. And but he knows how to promote. And
He does. And he gets all the publicity, and Boeing don't.
Well, because they don't know how to promote. They don't believe in promotion like Musk does.
No, they don't seem to. Nobody's ever even heard of them, probably. unless you, yes.
Kim, what else?
A few people would know that they're sort of neck and neck with SpaceX.
Yeah, Kim, do you have anything else, or I want to clear the line?
Sure, one other thing, because Robert was talking in the article about a full crew on the Dragon 2, and it actually isn't going to be like that. It's just those two people who want to go, and there's not going to be anybody else on that capsule, which implies a lot of things as well. One thing, it again suggests that these people have a background, and it also means that there's a lot more leeway to have backups and extra supplies in case things go wrong.
Yeah, they could... put more non-human special cargo and equipment on it.
Yeah, duplicates of carbon scrubbers and all, or any carbon scrubbers and everything else that they might need, duplicates of maybe life support.
A couple of cheap, lightweight caskets, you know, things like that they could put on board. I guess that's not very funny, but... Kim, can I clear the line? Are you okay?
Yes, for sure. Yep.
Okay, if it's a slow day and you want to call back, please do. Listeners, Kim has vacated the line, and thank you for calling in. And the toll-free line is available for anybody else who wants to call and talk to Robert. 1-866-687-7223. But, Robert, you haven't just been penning an article on why you wouldn't fly to the moon on SpaceX. You've published two books, and you've got a whole body of other papers and work that you've been talking about, and including you've done more work on planetary protection, right?
Yes, that's right, yes. In fact, that's the latest thing that I'm working on is my OK to Touch, which is talking about the human instinct to want to touch things and then looking at planetary protection issues. And that's the book that I've been working on actually for the last 3 months. I actually wrote it in response to a thing called Touch in the Title, which was done for National Geographic, just a short little video. I thought, oh, I'll write an article in response to that. And it turned out this book, which is now more than 800 pages.
800 pages?
Yes, yes.
Is it online or can we buy the book?
It's online and you can buy it, both of those.
Give us the full name of it.
Yes, it's called OK to Touch, Mars question. If you just go OK to Touch Mars, then it'll come up with a video. But add Europa question mark, Enceladus question mark, or a tale of misstep. And I thought of the analogy of the Lascaux Caves that's in the introduction of it, and how human beings touching Lascaux Caves have caused problems that were never anticipated, and just by going there and breathing and things. And then I sort of expand on that analogy, and I look at the injury part. And it's not just planetary protection in the case, in the sense of, it is in the sense of introducing life, which is obviously a central thing, but I also look at things like, for instance, trash heaps on the moon, which is something people don't really cover. You know, so that was quite a fun thing that I wrote very recently in it, and it doesn't seem to be all that much about it. You think about how much trash that comes out of the ISS, and it burns up in our atmosphere, but you couldn't burn it up in the atmosphere if you had a lunar base. So you're going to have piles of trash piled up around the base. What's going to happen? And there's all sorts of anything of that nature of, you know, the impact of humans as we travel out into space.
So what happens to the trash? They put it out into space or send it back?
That's the question. It wouldn't really make much sense unless you had something like the Hoyt tether system, which would let you send payloads from the lunar surface right down to the Earth's atmosphere for almost no delta V at all. So that is that would be a way of getting rid of trash from the moon right down to the Earth's atmosphere. And that is actually, I think, quite a feasible thing to do. And in both ways, it would make very easy to send payloads back and forth. But apart from that, you know, maybe they bury it. And maybe they just make huge trash heaps. Maybe they fill craters with it. There have been a few papers on this, but there's not really that much material in the literature on it. And for instance, the present day spacesuits, they only last, I think, 24, I'm not sure if the latest, maybe it's more missions, but after you had 24 EVAs, your spacesuit's pretty much done, and you'd have to get another one. So they would get loads and loads of spacesuits that would pile up if they're doing lots of EVAs. And, you know, so it might be very useful for future people to have like a pile of spacesuits in one place and a pile of bits of, you know, and then later on they might be able to use them as resources for making things in the future. We've got more than industry in the future. It'd be quite a resource on the surface of the moon.
Use spacesuit warehouse. Here, you got another email from and listener, use the phone if you guys can do it. It's so much more fun. 1-866-687-7223. So Doug is sending you another email from the land of Oz, La La Land, down there in Southern California. On February 15th, we got word about NASA being asked to look into the feasibility of crew being placed on the first SLS flight. Only 12 days later, Elon mentioned two people wanting to do the same mission on the Falcon Heavy. Coincidence? What do you make of it, Robert?
Oh, I have wondered if there's a connection. And I'm just as critical of the SLS. I mean, look, you haven't got the issues of passengers. And as I say, as Kim was saying, you know, if these two people, if we don't know who they are, haven't been trained to test pilots, then it's a little, it does put a very different complexion on it. So these people with SLS would be test pilots, but still, you know, I can't actually say like FAA, you don't do it, but I can say as an external observer, it doesn't seem like the right way to do it. It's just far too rapid. Even if their rocket is okay, there's just so many unknowns in just the very first flight of the SLS going around the moon and coming back and having human beings on board, and the life support hasn't been tested before, the re-entry hasn't been tested before, all these things not been tested before. And I think that even the second flight would be too soon. I think that really what they did with Apollo 8 is still to this day what you would need for a mission like that. That you would have at least to have the equivalent of Apollo 4 and the equivalent of Apollo 7. So you have the re-entry tested unmanned module, and you have the equivalent duration mission in LEO so you can get back to Earth. And I don't think it's right even, you know, I mean, just in the sense of the setback that there would be if they all died, and only because they hadn't put in these extra missions before, which would seem to be essential for safety. And it just seems there'd be such a huge setback. And people would be saying, you know, this is what they should have done. Why didn't they do it? And it would be quite a setback, and it would also be a personal tragedy. And you would look and say, why? You know, what an awful thing this happened when if they'd only done this extra missions like they did for Apollo 8. So I am quite critical of SLS as well.
What about what they did with the space shuttle when they put people on it? Because that sort of goes against what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, they didn't have any choice there. With the space shuttle, and that was going up into it's different when you don't have any choice, and when you do have a choice, and it's different also. They were going up to, they weren't going around the moon or anything like that.
No, they're going to Leo.
Yes. So, but they had no choice to put humans on board because that's how it was designed, and they didn't have a launch escape system, and that's what it turned out. Then, and so, I mean, just want to say something about launch escape system that I go along with what Doug Messier says about launch escape systems, that they are not meant, you know, Elon Musk was saying that, look, we've got launch escape system, so, you know, it doesn't matter if our rockets blow up, you know, like, well, I didn't actually say it in as many words, but that was a sort of kind of implication, but if you look at it, rockets, you wouldn't even test, they'd only test the launch escape system with dummies. I don't think they would test the launch escape system with real people. It's a very much a last resort that you don't want to be triggered. So maybe if the space shuttle had had a launch escape system, then it would have saved the astronauts in the first one where it sort of blew up when it was going up. But there again, it might not have, because like with the Soyuz, where it almost, the only launch escape system that's actually happened in real life, then the actual wiring burnt through, and it wasn't triggered automatically like it should have, and they had to go through a very complex system of manually triggering it, and they just got it triggered within seconds before it was too late. So launch escape systems, you know, they're very much last resort, and they're not to be relied on as a matter of course thing.
Another email for you, Carol, and excuse me, is in Seattle, and she says, Robert, I'm curious for your opinion. SpaceX has been launching rockets now for many, many years, and the government, of course, has been launching rockets forever, it seems, and they have lots of experience, as do the big commercial companies that make the rockets. Why, in your opinion, is it so difficult for SpaceX and for SLS to be manufactured, developed, and accurately timelined for launches? Why do things always have to slip? Why do things always get delayed? Why can't they do any of this on time?
Well, I mean, I just think it's very challenging, and they are, as these things have shown, you can't actually simulate everything that's going to happen. the things that happened during the Apollo that they couldn't have predicted, and the things happening, you can't in a computer, even with on computer simulations, things are going to happen that you can't simulate in advance. So I mean that's all that I, you know, I think that's about it really. But I think that's why it slips, because things come up that they couldn't have anticipated, because real life is more messy than what you anticipated was going to happen.
You don't think there's a quality control issue going on with these companies, and maybe their checks and balances and manufacturing processes that maybe they should be better at?
Well, yeah. Yes. I mean, that is the issue that Duke Metz has brought up a lot, especially this matter of the strut that failed at £2,000 when it should have had, when the supply said it was £10,000. Why didn't SpaceX test it instead of just accepting the manufacturer's word for it? You know, it just seems a little bit, you know, they shouldn't have had to do that after it happened. Why? So as a young company, obviously, they're making this, that I think is basically a mistake. You know, it's a mistake of a young company that is new to this. And so you have this question, you have placed anything else of that nature, which is just basically a mistake, which might still, as they haven't got all the wrinkles out to it. So I think that's the point as well, because they're a very young company.
I have another email, and then we're going to take a break, okay?
Okay.
So John is in Boston,
yeah.
And John says comes to my attention that I believe most in the space advocacy community are extremely eager for human space flight to Mars, for returning to the moon, and they believe that it is a lot simpler and easier to do than it probably is. Plus, they dismiss many of the risks, including human factors that David likes to talk about on his show, medical risk, radiation risk, microgravity, etc., and believe it's okay, as David argued early in the show, that if you want to take the risk and go, and if something bad happens to you, it's on you, no big deal. However, it does not seem like the excitement and the exuberance of the emerging commercial space and space advocacy communities have enough power to influence regulatory and policy-making people. So while I, too, am in a hurry to see humans go to Mars and do other things, my hunch is, Robert, your ideas are more likely to prevail than the space advocacy ideals. This might change were we to have a president to come out with a really plus and very aggressive space advocacy-like policy, or maybe something happening that catapulted space advocacy type policy to the forefront, but I don't see that happening. Perhaps a NASA administrator that had space advocacy policy and settlement as a priority would help, but right now I don't even see that happening. Do you have any thoughts on what I'm saying? I know that space advocacy is not as popular and powerful in the United Kingdom as it is in the United States, but you do have experience with our space advocates through blog posts and your articles and your presence on radio programs here in the United States.
Okay. I think we need to disentangle two things here. So there's the question of whether you can have the leadership in order to get more humans in space. So we do actually have this here in Europe as well, with the idea of the ESA Village. So they are getting together this idea of actually getting humans to be on the, in this village on the moon. And so this is quite a forward-looking thing, which the ESA is wanting to lead and get together people from Russia and even maybe China and, you know, Japan, from all sorts of places, to come together to start up a village on the moon, which is like the ISS, but a more loose organization of people. And they're thinking this is happening maybe in 2020s, beyond the end of ISS. So this is actually a vision for the future. Now, I say you can have visions like that, and the USA could join in that to have their own vision. I think that is separate from the idea of whether you need to go into space in the case of doing it very quickly, like some of the space advocates seem to be saying, like for instance, doing an Apollo 8, missing out, doing it in two flights instead of four. just in order to speed it up. I do not see the point in doing what should be done in 4 space flights in 2 space flights. Just have half the number of space flights, missing out things that would make it 6. I just don't see any point in that at all. But if you have the leadership, then you could easily have humans going back to the moon without having to sacrifice safety at all, and do it in a responsible way. So as Marcus was saying, in a way that is risky but not reckless, and managed risk, and loading the dice in your favour, which you have to do if you're going to space, because it's plenty dangerous enough as it is. So I think we need to separate these things out. And I think if the human space advocates who start saying, and we should go risky into space, I think once, if they actually have a practical experience of trying that approach and then getting everyone dying in some very spectacular accident, then I think they might change. I think it's better to change in advance before that. And that's why I put this kind of fake news, future fake news. I've been starting using little future fake news stories in my, both my books and in this article. And I think that kind of maybe helps a little bit. People actually think, well, you know, this actually might happen in the future. That we might, these might actually be news stories that we might read. And how would we react? And so I would say that it's putting these two things together. And if we separate them out and say we could have this leadership of having humans in space without at the same time having to do the risky as well, the reckless as well. And if we can kind of separate that out, then we can have both. We can have leadership of responsible and risky but not reckless humans in space.
I'll do one more quick email, and then we'll take the break. I know we're way over. excuse me, listener. Louise is in Tucson, and again, phone calls are preferred, 1-866-687-7223. So Louise is in Tucson, and she says, Robert, in your opinion, do we need to crawl first before we walk? And in crawling, I'm talking about doing, managing, and successfully handling suborbital space tourism. Does that need to be in place and be proven safe and effective before we're able to handle orbital tourism, or does it make a difference?
I don't really see why we need to do suborbital first. I think it's just a matter of, it's just a different thing, because it's going to be lower cost and it's going to have its different, and some people might go suborbital first, like that obviously with Virgin Galactic's route. But I mean, from what I've read and understood, I don't really see why that's a necessary stage, although it's a possible stage, and that's really how she was asking my opinion on it.
So you don't see suborbital as an essential first step?
No. I don't see any problem with them going orbital straight away on the basis of what we've got, if it's the same pocket.
Listeners, I'm going to take a pause. I really am going to do it, and because we're a little over the line with Robert. Excuse me, and we're going to be back in about 3 minutes, so don't go anywhere. The phone line is available if you would like to give us a call, and again, we do want to hear from you, 1-866-687-7223. So we do take the calls during the break, as you know, and we'll hold you until Robert's ready to talk again. So back, everybody, 3 minutes. Don't go anyplace.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Monday Space Show, and our guest is Robert Walker over from the UK. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and we do have several sponsors for the second segment of today's program. Orbital ATK is our global leader in aerospace and defense technologies. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. The AIAA is a partner, a sponsor, excuse me. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the world's largest aerospace pro society. They have over 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members. They are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe, and certainly bringing the world closer together. You can join them, get more information at AIAA.org, and I am in the process of making my plans to attend AIAA in Orlando in September. I believe it is at the Orlando Hyatt Hotel, but I am going to be attending, and hopefully many of you will be there. I did run into Sandy Magnus at the Space Foundation, and we talked about how they're planning to alternate venues between California and Florida, because the space market of professionals, if professionals can be a market, is different on the Florida coast versus the California coast. And so this is sort of going to be an outreach strategy, I think, for AIAA to gather in more professionals from both venues. And I told Sandy that even though I'd much prefer it to be in Southern California, given my location, I think it's a wise strategy. So if you are planning to be in Orlando, or you're going to be at the Cape or in that area, excuse me, do let me know. I'd love to meet up with you. And then the final sponsor for today's show is Celestis, and they have their DNA service that I have been talking about. Celestis is the leading Memorial Spaceflight Service since 1997. And it used to be you flew the cremated remains, about 1 ounce or 1 gram, I should say, of your loved one. But now you can fly their DNA, and you can also fly your own DNA with your loved one. And so they have partnered with CG Labs in Canada. This is a world leader in DNA collection. And if you're interested in this service, this is really cool, because you can at least symbolically join your loved one on a ride to space and becoming part of the cosmic energy as eventually the spacecraft re-enters Earth's atmosphere and burns up in the atmosphere. Again, for disclosure purposes, I am a customer of Celestis. I love the company, the people. It's one of the best businesses I've ever been fortunate enough to deal with in my life. And if you are in need or desire of their services, you will be very, very well taken care of, and it will be an incredibly memorable event for you and your family. We do have a lot of other topics to talk with Robert about, but I do have a caller on hold, which I'm going to prioritize. So, hi, caller. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm back.
Oh, you're back. Okay, go for it, Kim.
There's just one more thing. It was interesting to me that probably the limiting factor for who is healthy enough to make this trip would be the abort system. And it is going to be on a Falcon Heavy, so I don't know how this translates to the Falcon Heavy. But in the case of Soyuz, if the abort system fires, yeah, you'll undergo 14 G's of force for several seconds.
How long do you get to do the 14 G's?
Something like 5 seconds.
Okay.
But for those 5 seconds, that's enough to knock you out. Apparently, for a healthy person, and I don't know how that's defined, it's not a really big deal. I bet it hurts like hell afterwards, but you can live through it. But I imagine there's a point at which that you just can't do that anymore.
Well, if you're a fighter pilot, Kim, and you have to eject from your cockpit, you're going to have a hell of a ride, and a lot of them have injuries from it and have back injuries, and these guys are in prime physical condition, and they do not always come out of that ejection healthy without injuries. So I don't know how many G's that solid rocket motor under your butt gets you up to get you away from that plane, but that's a rough ride if you have to make the ejection. And I'm assuming that, you know, it's pretty similar or comparable on the one you just described with the Soyuz, probably maybe more significant on the Soyuz. But I did a show years ago, Kim, with people who flew the MiG to the edge of space, as high as the MiG would go. They took the, I think it was like a $20,000 ride 10 years ago in Russia, because at the time you couldn't do this in the United States. It was against the law, but that has changed. So they would go to Russia to fly these really high MiG flights and see the curvature of the Earth and the Terminator line. And they said that when they got in the MiG, and I forget which MiG they were flying in, part of their instructions from the Russians and the pilot were that if you hear the pilot go in English, eject, eject, eject three times, you damn well better hold on for your life and your limbs and your arms and do what you were instructed, because you're in for the roughest ride you've ever had in your life. And that's on several space show programs from people who did fly those high altitude MiG flights. That was part of their instruction training from the pilots, if they had to eject them on something going wrong with those high flying MiG flights.
Yeah, to me that just adds a whole other wrinkle to what is safe for passengers on flights like this, and what the training should be. Just a great example, you know, how weird this is, how outside normal experience that the whole thing is.
For my politically incorrect comment, if weight is not a qualifying factor for a spaceflight participant, that is, do you have to be within certain weight guidelines, or can you be really overweight and fat like people who get on an airplane and half their body is in my seat? So I'm wondering, if you are overweight and somehow you're doing a spaceflight like that, does the extra mass that the abort system have to eject real quickly because you're so fat have anything to do with the physics and the energy of it? So I have no idea, and as I said, that's my politically incorrect comment regarding overweight and obese people. But Robert, you probably know more about that than I do. Could you have someone who's flying who is really fat and overweight, and it impairs the abort system?
Well, I'm sorry, I have been reading about the abort system quite recently, but I can't remember the gene, so I'm feeling it was somewhat less than for the Soyuz, for the SpaceX, but I can't actually remember the exact figures. I have a number in my mind, but I don't know what I actually want to say it in case it's wrong, to give the wrong impression. If any reader happens to know, then perhaps they could say. I do think it was less than for the Soyuz, the actual genes that they have.
I wonder, maybe Dr. Doug knows, maybe if there's any requirements on height and weight. I mean, does a person who wants to be a spaceflight participant, do they have to be within certain weight tables, or could you be an obese passenger, and wouldn't that cost more to launch you into space?
Yeah, it's too specialist answer for me. If he happens to be, you know, maybe, you know, he could email or put in the comments. I'm sorry, I don't think I'm the one to answer that, really.
Okay.
You could say, you give me a chance to go away and research it, and could come back and see what I can find out about it, but I can't answer something like that on the spot.
Kim, anything else from you, or is that it?
No, I just wanted to add that, because I think it impacts the whole argument about how much risk is really involved.
Okay. Thank you, Kim. Listeners, she has vacated the line. It is 1-866-687-7223. Robert, I know we have some other things you want to talk about, but you have a note that came in during the break.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And this is from Paul, who is in New York City. And he says, I'm wondering, Robert, with your being in Europe, if you think there is any impact one way or another on space and the European Space Agency, given the vote that was held in France yesterday. Do any of these candidates that won have a position on space, on ESA, the Lunar Village? Have you seen anything about space in the French elections?
All I can say is that no, I haven't. But I haven't actually tried to look into that. I certainly haven't seen any stories in the news about space relating to that. So, sorry, I, Okay, I don't know the answer if there's any difference or any effect. I mean, ESA is not just France, it's the entire Europe together. So
right.
And Germany is based, purist business are very important on ESA, I would imagine. So I would be surprised if it had a significant effect, but I can't actually say from knowledge.
You have another caller. I know you want to get to some other topics, but... Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And welcome to our program.
Hi, this is Doug from Southern California.
Oh, and a clear phone line. Cool.
Oh, good.
Great.
Go for it.
Yeah, just respond to your question about obese passenger. My, math is math, so of course an obese passenger is going to affect the performance. However, I think the difference in mass from an average passenger and obese passenger, that difference in mass is probably a relatively small percentage of the overall mass of the capsule and escape tower, et cetera. So I think that, I'm sure they would take it into account, but probably it wouldn't make the difference.
But, boy, it'd probably make you mad if half his body was hanging over into your seat like it is on Southwest Airlines.
Of course.
I think we've all had to experience that from time to time.
But the new Shepherd is pretty roomy, isn't it?
Yes, when at the Space Foundation, when people were going in it, they took seven people into it for some sort of a simulation. And I didn't go in it because the lines were way too long, but I did look through the window. And the seven people, you would have to be 10 times the size of Michael Moore to hang over into the guy next to you. So I don't think that would happen, but they would have to launch extra mass, obviously, if you had a whole crew of, if you had an obese flight. One time, Doug, coming back from, teaching in Grand Forks, and this was when Northwest was still the airline. It had not merged with Delta. And I'm in the coach department because that's where North Dakota would buy my ticket. And it had the fattest people I have ever seen on my life on an airplane. I'm not kidding you. Teenage girls that probably weighed 300 pounds. But it wasn't just a few of them. It was like two-thirds of the coach department. And I was sitting next to one of them, and they were from a Minneapolis dessert tasting club. I swear to God, this is the truth. And they had a book on where to go around the country for incredible desserts. And they chose to go to San Francisco for a weekend to go dessert tasting. And this club from Minneapolis was in the coach section of the plane. And if 300 pounds was probably an average size for some of these people, including the teenagers, and they were all sharing these books that they had about which dessert place and what dessert they couldn't wait to go taste when they got to San Francisco for the weekend. I've never seen anything like that on an airplane in my life.
Let me go ahead and sort of give my own answer to a question I asked earlier by email, and then after that I have a question for Robert. It seems to me as that the timing of the SpaceX announcement about flight around the moon compared with the SLS announcement about them doing the same seems to me way too coincident. And I think there have to be an explanation for that. Doug Messier on Parabolic Arc addressed this question. I think he's got the right idea, and that is, understandably, I think Elon Musk has totally... his eyes are totally set on Mars for his own reasons. And whereas I think he's committed to going to Mars, whether there's a public-private program or not, I think he certainly would like to have a public-private program. So at this point in time, it looks like the idea that the moon is back on the table seems quite credible right now, and I think that would make Elon concerned. So as... NASA's being asked to go ahead and look into this issue as to whether SLS could do a lunar flyby. I think at that point in time, whether at SpaceX's initiative or at other people's initiative outside of SpaceX, but they're like, boy, we had better, get in the news that we could possibly do this with Falcon Heavy at much less cost, and try to sort of nip that direction in the bud.
So you want to? You think they might want to control the news and the events around this?
Well, you know, as opposed to just leaving this idea that, oh, maybe NASA should go to the moon, if immediately there's a follow-up announcement or a company announcement that, oh, by the way, SpaceX could do it with Falcon Heavy, and we can do it for a lot less. However, NASA is our partner, and we appreciate them, et cetera, but, you know, the point comes across of why should we spend so much money doing it on SLS when we can do it much less expensively on Falcon Heavy? I think that might be behind the motivation for the timing of that announcement. So my point is I think that SpaceX and Elon was probably not planning on announcing this, probably don't have much interest in the moon at all, but in the context of that situation, I think that they sort of felt like they needed to throw this in and to try to and talk about doing it in a short-term time frame, which they wouldn't normally have done. Anyhow, let me ask my question.
Okay, that's interesting anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Robert, would you be able to say sort of for yourself, sort of quantify what level of risk you think is acceptable? If private individuals were to want to do this Falcon Heavy flyby, you know, Dragon 2 flyby around the moon, and if there was a 1 in 10 chance that they would die, is that an acceptable level? How about 1 out of 50, 1 out of 100? Could one actually quantify a reasonable level of risk?
Well, I'm not sure if it's so much a probability thing as a matter of them taking all the best precautions that they can with the technology they have available today and not sending passengers on envelope-extending missions. I think that for the actual launch itself, then because we have these rockets that are so safe, like the Atlas V and like the Soyuz, that if you're going to compete with that, then you want to launch that is not going to explode even for quite a lot, maybe 50 or more flights without an explosion, is what you would want to do either on the launch pad or during the takeoff. And if you haven't got that much, then you know that's a level of risk where the space flight where it would be reasonable to say, well, I'm not going to fly on that. So I think we've already got that just from the kind of competition of the ones that can do safe space flight. So it's more like reckless than risky to actually go on something that's more dangerous than is necessary. And so I think that's part of it. And so when it comes to going around the moon, then I think at the minimum you want to have tested like Apollo 7. You want to then go around the moon and the envelope thing with test pilots. And then once you've done that, send humans around the moon. And then at that point, you could say, well, I think with SpaceX that it's actually better for them to have more flights than would actually be necessary in that. For something like the SLS, and then test pilots may actually not think in terms of passengers as far as I know. But if you were thinking in terms of passengers, and if you did have this issue that you can't actually just earn from your test flights, then maybe the reason for doing it is accelerated. But with something like SpaceX, there's no lot to be said for them actually doing it a little bit slower, just on this basis that they are capable of doing it. And again, it seems kind of reckless to not do the extra flights that they could very easily do. I think this distinction between risky and reckless is quite a good one that Mike Lister put in. And so reckless is sort of kind of missing out steps that you could do easily. And I think that's probably a better way of thinking about it than trying to work out the probability for the different stages myself.
So do you accept the idea, it's been mentioned on the space show before, sort of in the distant past, of the idea that different missions, it's appropriate for different types of missions to have different levels of risk? So if
yes.
You're doing, you do accept that?
Yes, I do.
What's your rationale for accepting that?
Well, it's just this thing. I think that Michael Lister's difference between risky and reckless is really the rationale in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, so if it's, I think I that's not the thing that I've even had anyone suggest before. But now that you've said that, I'll obviously be thinking about that quite a bit. But I think that's a very good way of kind of clarifying my own thinking And I think that is really is about what you're thinking about a bit. But I think that is a very good way of putting it. And I think I'll be talking some more after this talk.
So during the Apollo program, we sent people to the moon, and it's been said, the astronauts said that they felt like they had a 50-50 chance of dying, and yet they were willing to accept that risk. But it was a rather big achievement as opposed to, say, for example, a shuttle flight delivering underwear, you know. So you would say that what we did in the Apollo program was worth that level of risk?
Yes. And, well, I mean, from a scientific point of view, then I would actually side with Carl Sagan. It wasn't worth it from a scientific point of view. So there's always this thing with humans in space. How much is it worth it because sending humans up there? So in the same way, the ISS is not the way you do it if science was your priority. So the ISS is some kind of mixture between humans wanting political reasons to have lots of human beings in space in zero gravity and then also doing some science as well. And it does do a lot of good science, but it's not designed around science. In the same way, the Apollo mission was not designed around science. And if you wanted to have a science mission to the moon, you would have done it differently. But and then Carl Sagan was saying, first of all, that he wouldn't have done it like that if his main thing was science. Then, having done that, it's like having a Rolls Royce, that once you got to Apollo 17, then they should have kept on with it. So it's like having a Rolls Royce going to the moon a few times, then saying, okay, I'm going to put it in the garage and forget about it. So by the time they put all that initiative into sending humans to the moon, then they had something which would have been very excellent, and we could have learned a huge amount about the moon if they'd just done a few more missions after that. So I'm like that to see from a science point of view. And I think it's the same with that you can have humans going into space, and the main thing is human factors reasons and political reasons and so forth, but then that can maybe in the future actually have better science return in the end than if you didn't do it like that, even though the immediate notification, it just depends what they're doing. So I think Apollo was like that. It started off as being a human political thing, but it had a lot of science value as well, and the science value could have gradually taken over, and they could have even much more scientifically rich than they were. But I think it did have a very great deal of human interest as well, and that you can't really evaluate from a scientific point of view. And then as far as taking the risks, then I think it's very significant. These were test pilots, and they knew from their own, they knew how they could evaluate themselves very well. They knew from experience. They had been in very risky situations before. They knew how they would be able to cope with high levels of risk. And for instance, and Tom Stafford with the Apollo 10, he had to have a very cool head when they started spinning around, and they were just within seconds of them all dying, and they managed to sort it out. Now, anyone who hadn't been a test pilot and been through such things before and was really very cool like them, they would have panicked, and they probably wouldn't have got out of it at all, and they'd all be dead. So it's
right.
So part of the reason why it was a reasonable thing for them to do was because not just the spacecraft, but because they themselves had, tested systems themselves as test pilots and very experienced in being able to cool things and knowing that in an emergency, within seconds, they are able to evaluate quickly and coolly do just the right thing, which anybody else, the likes of you and me, but I don't know about you unless you're a test pilot, but certainly me, I'd have just panicked and I'd be looking to we're running around and then I would probably spend 10 or 20 seconds doing that, at least probably a minute or two, and by then it would be too late and I'd be dead.
Yeah. Well, let me go ahead and sign off here, Robert, but I just want to say I appreciate your post on Science 2.0. I read them all.
Great. Thank you.
Don't always agree with everything, but you well thought out and well supported evidence, so keep it coming.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Sure. Yes, I think I'm going to do extracts from my OK to Touch Mars my Lunar Astronaut on the Moon, but certainly I'm going to buy it. I wanted to finish my OK to Touch Mars, which is pretty much finished now, and I'm actually going through copy editing it. And the influence of copy editing, I keep coming up with these new things and saying, oh, I should have a chapter on that, and I haven't yet. And it's sort of growing and growing, and it's well over 800 pages now in the Kindle format. which is more or less the box space of printed book, and I think I wouldn't be surprised if it reaches 1,000 pages before it's finished. We'll see. But I'm going to be doing extracts from it on my Twitter blog once it's finished.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Yes.
Listeners, Doug has cleared the line. It is 1-866-687-7223. You have a thing about wanting to do Europa, don't you?
Oh, yes, I want to talk about Europa. That's very topical just now. So, because, of course, Trump has... the new Trump administration has done a lot of cancellation, but they haven't cancelled Europa Multiplied Flyby Mission, but they have cancelled the Europa Lander. And then, at the same time, we have just had these recent things about the Europa Geyser. And this one seems to be... I cover this in quite depth in my Orbit of Touch Mars. So I have a long section, I have multiple kind of like chapters about this, about the Europa situation. It's very, very interesting. And I was actually one of the few people who was actually saying a huge sigh of relief that they've cancelled the Europa Lander, because unlike a lot of decisions, this is very, very unusual, that it is a robotic mission, not a human mission, that is mandated by Congress. It's very rare form, or mandated by the U.S. government. I'm not sure technically exact branch how exactly it happened, but they were mandated to that they have to send a flyby mission, and then they have to send a lander. So there's no scientific evaluation of the different possible missions, and so these scientists were ending up having to design a lander because they were told that's what they have to do. And this lander was going to land there and be there for 3 weeks, and they didn't really have a scientific justification. And especially now we look in terms of the geysers. So the way you think it is that the geysers coming out from the Europa Ocean, or it's not necessarily, it could be coming from subsurface reservoirs that actually plumes that have risen from the ocean and then taking off. And they don't really know for Europa, though they do know for Enceladus, they're pretty sure that they've actually got the hydrogen and they've got silica particles that suggest that the geysers have actually originated in hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, that some have managed to get all the way into space. There's quite strong evidence that it may actually be coming directly just from a few months earlier, or even less, that it actually was originating that in the hydrothermal vent, which is quite unusual, because in the Earth hydrothermal vents, then the microbes only rise about 100 meters, and they go horizontally in the ocean, and they wouldn't get all the way to the surface. But in Europa, perhaps because of low gravity and things, and it seems that material from the hydrothermal vents is going right out into Enceladus. Now, the big question is the same happening with Europa? So, but it seems there's quite a possibility that there is life in Europa, and some of it may be getting to the geysers. But now, even if you go in your lander, and you land on the surface, close to one of these geysers, but you only would have a few microbes, and this whole surface is going to be covered with what could be originally organics from the ocean, but most likely an awful lot of it is going to be organics from meteorites. And it's probably, if there is organics there, it's probably mostly going to be sodens, which are when you get ionizing radiation sort of break up the organics. They don't just break it up into kind of water vapor and carbon dioxide. They get lots of free bonds which then join together to make this complex gunk called sodin. So this lander would go and land on the surface, and it would probably give us a very excellent study, the first ever study of sodens. And I don't think it's very likely that they would be able to extract, even if there are microbes in there, even if it's got lots of innovative ideas, such as looking at them optically, but it's not actually got any dedicated life instruments. So the combination of these two is not actually going to be testing for life directly, but it's got the instruments for a dual purpose. Plus, and that was one of their directives, I don't think that came from Congress, I think it was from higher level amongst the scientists. And then this directive from Congress, it has to be a lander, when the obvious thing to do is send guys to fly through. And then it also has significant planetary protection things, because the surface of Europa is not very well known. We don't know it, but it's like a meter scale. There is, for instance, the idea of Peniton, which they're not... Lots of people are skeptical about the idea of Penitons on the Earth are caused by melting, and the temperature in Europa is far too cold for melting. But these are little spikes that could be up to several meters high that could completely cover most of the surface of Europa. And so on a small scale, it could be very, very rough and extremely difficult to land on. That's one possible theory. And it doesn't get anything like warm enough for melting, but the ice over millions of years, then you have heating and then you have sublimation of the ice. So a lot of people miss this point when they read this paper. And they think it's about melting, but it's not. It's about sublimation. And ice at like 0 degrees centigrade, you lose meters I think it's meters a day. So this is a temperature that's quite low, and you'd use just meters every few million years. But that's enough to get this spiky surface if you have uneven sublimation. So that's one theory. But another thing is that they actually have large areas of the European surface that they, especially the most interesting areas, like the macula, where the ice surface is actually actively turning over right now. At least they think it's possible. They see evidence. They look at these little chunks which had lines that originally joined up, but they don't anymore. They've obviously turned around. They've created gaps. And I can't remember the percentage, whether it's 40 or 50% or something, but a high percentage of what was originally surface has just gone, tumbled over, turned, broken up, turned into icebergs, and then turned over and broken to pieces. So we've got, so we think about landing, the most interesting place on the surface, not a good place to land a lander. It's quite a good chance they would just wouldn't, the most interesting, the only flat places would be uninteresting. And that the lander, if it did go anywhere interesting, it had to disappear. So I agree with them that if the lander landed on a flat surface, it's stable for 2,000 years or something, and it's going to have ionizing radiation on the lander, and it's successful, and it doesn't, and you, nothing goes wrong during landing, then at that point it doesn't have very much plant protection issues because the ionizing radiation would eventually sterilize it because there's so much. But I think there's significant plant protection issues because we don't know enough about the surface and we don't know how to design the lander. And I think the very obvious thing to do is what we need to do next. The other thing is I think it's wrong to focus so much on Europa. So if we do just one at a time, we just go Europa for, say, 20 years, and then we don't find any life there, so we go to Enceladus for 20 years, and then maybe we decide Ceres was where we should have been to going all along, or maybe we decide with Titan. So we've got these four places that are potentially of interest for the search of life, plus Mars as well. I think we should be doing, we know at this stage that going through the geysers is an obviously interesting thing to do, and we could do similar missions with the Titan, rather similar, and we could do flybys of the Enceladus of Cassini-type flybys in Saturn. We can also look at Dione and Rhea and Mimas, which all potentially have subsurface oceans, very remote possibility of geysers, but we can find out a lot about the subsurface oceans there. So I think we should be thinking in having multiple missions that are simultaneously looking at these places at the same level. And it also means that you're doing geyser samples, you do them all in the next few years. Instead of doing geyser sample now of Europa, then so 20 years later you do your geyser sample of Enceladus, and you then have to do it designed from scratch. Now, I also think it's very significant to send biological, actually searching for life right away, because the way they're planning to do it now, they're doing very much like on Mars. They look for habitability, and they do that for lots of missions, two, three, four missions, before they eventually would go and look for life in the directly there. I think that they should be, as long as there's a possibility of life in the fluids, which there would seem to be, and we can't really, but it could be a very unusual life, so we can't really say too much about whether it could be there or not, except by actually looking for it. So I think we should be looking for life right now in these plumes, and because a normal result is very significant, for the same reason that you want to know where to focus your searches. And so, you know, you go into the Europa plume and you get no result. Then you say, well, we've got to do drilling down to the oceans there if we want to find out more. Or you find that there is life there. So I think we should be sending, as the world should be, we actually should be sending focused life detectors, which are now just a few kilograms, instead of having this requirement, it's always got to be able to tell us about. So we obviously, you want to look at the the chemistry and the all this stuff, but you also want to have focused life things, I think, at an early stage to either find it or not, given that you're going to do that at some point. Well, why not do it straight away? So, and it also gives you experience in actually building these instruments, which have never had any flying since Viking. So, anyway, sorry, I'm a bit passionate about this, but I've got a whole long section in Orchid Touch Bars about this. And anyway, I just wanted to say that to you.
You have another email, and are you okay with staying a few extra minutes? Because I know it's late for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, are we near the end already? How is it?
Oh, we're way past the end. So
oh, are we?
Yeah, we're still going. But Andrew is in Denver,
and he
says, Robert, this has not yet been talked about, but I have often wondered that we should be prioritizing funding to seriously develop advanced propulsion, mainly nuclear, so that we could do Europa and other missions a lot faster. My premise is that if we could do these missions faster and maybe more affordable with advanced propulsion that we developed, we would kindle more interest in planetary science and space exploration and generate more funding and generate more missions. I think the fact that these missions take so long, given planning and development and chemical rocket propulsion, works against getting the necessary funding to do them and to launching all the projects that are needed for good quality space science. I think if we prioritized our funding to really develop advanced nuclear propulsion to do this faster, we would benefit the entire industry.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, certainly it's a thing that's well worth following. I think that, but I just want to make a little comment that actually with chemical propulsion we can get to Saturn rather more quickly than you would think. You can actually get, I think it's three years or something to Saturn. Unless you're doing, we tend to think it takes a very long time to do that, but as long as you're, especially with things like the Falcon Heavy or something like that, then you go to a more or less direct path there, then it's not as long as you would think. And so, this time scale, I think it's 3 years if I remember right, on the fast home on France. There's a slow one and there's a fast one. And if you can go on the fast one, I think it's 3 years. I'd have to check it. I've got it in my book. And so that's the kind of time scale which is really actual transport days. It's less of a issue that you could imagine finding something interesting and saying, oh, well, we've got to send another mission. The actual, it would take, as you said, it would take a little while designing instruments, even though we've already got a few. And then you could send another one, you're talking about 3 or 4 years. So I'm not sure. I think it's well worth following up. So I'm not saying it's not, but I'm just adding as an extra thing that the chemical propulsion is maybe not quite as long as you'd expect, because we had missions that have required this way. It's really been rather low delta B that they've had to go with. And that if you just somewhat increase that, you wouldn't have with the new rockets, then it mightn't be so much as an issue you'd think, but it's obviously well worth following up.
So you wouldn't necessarily agree with Andrew's idea?
Oh, I think it's definitely a good thing to follow up. I just don't know if that's our top priority. It might be. I'm just saying. I'm sort of sitting on the fence here.
Do you have another email question from Linda? And mm-hmm. Linda is also, is in Boston. And she says, many people talk about human spaceflight, but to the upper atmosphere and clouds of Venus rather than Mars. And Dr. Landis, for example, has made the case that there are sweet spots in the upper Venetian atmosphere that make it very, very similar to the habitat of Earth's environment, making it an easier place for settlement, for example, than Mars. Yet I've not heard you talk about human spaceflight or anything about Venus or going to Venus. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Venus and humans?
I think that Venus is one of the more interesting places to send humans, and the main thing is to have for two things. First of all, because it is quite close to Earth, and there is actually a possibility of life there, and of native life there, you might think it's very unlikely. But according to some ideas about Venus, there could have been life there as recently as a few hundred million years ago. The atmosphere could have changed very rapidly according to some ideas and some models of the Venus development. And it could have been very Earth-like even as recently as maybe 300 million years ago, I think they said. And then it could have changed very rapidly due to an overall upheaval and loads of volcanoes sending lots of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And with a kind of global upheaval that is possible because it doesn't have plate tectonics. And then this then could have been the entire cause of the current atmosphere. So that's one theory. And so if there was life on the surface of Venus, so pretty much like Earth, until this upheaval, then due to it not having plate tectonics, then there's then you would start thinking, you know, could that sunset life have migrated into the atmosphere and still be there? Well, you're quite evolved life at that point, because it'd be billions of years evolved and get it up into the atmosphere. And then there is this indirect detection of various signals, that's particularly bits of modified particles. They call it these particles that seem to be non-spherical, which is quite surprising to find in the atmosphere. And this might possibly be microbes. They're just the right size for microbes.
And
so there could be life there. And if that's the case, there would be planet protection issues, and so then you would think about that. But if it's not habitable, so I think you should set robotic missions first. Now, we'll be taking one. But then, if it is suitable for human beings, and you work through these planet protection issues, and it sounds that it's okay to send humans there, then I think Venus is one of the most habitable places. I would say the top most habitable in our solar system that we know of, possibly the, well, of course, there's the poles of the moon, there's the caves of the moon, there's huge caves possibly of the moon. Now that's the astronaut garden on the moon, is all about that. And then there's the Venus upper atmosphere, like you're talking about. And this has the amazing feature that you could have the very lightweight habitats. So you get the most volume for the least launch mass in the Venus atmosphere of anywhere in the solar system that we know of. The only other one like that is Titan. So Titan has atmospheric pressure the same as Earth. You could actually live on the Titan surface. If there's no planet protection issue, then you could have humans on the Titan surface, and they actually have land they can walk at. And they just need insulation from the cold, but they actually have the same pressure outside and in. And so that's a huge simplification. You don't need pressurized spacesuits, and you don't need pressurized habitats. So that's the case on Titan. That's also the case in the Venus upper atmosphere. In Titan, you need protection from the cold. In the Venus upper atmosphere, you need protection from sulfuric acid. And because it's the same pressure inside and out, you don't have any possibility of your habitat exploding like it would do if you had a puncture. You also have meteorite protection above you, and you can have very lightweight habitat. And it is really much safer once you think through all the possibilities as a way of having large habitats for very low launch mass from Earth. And so if you can have a reason for humans to be there, and that is always the problem with human space settlement, but I think once you've got a reason for humans to be there, and if you have a way for them to get back again, which is not insoluble, and certainly going there, a kind of Venus one, is much easier than a Mars one, I think, in many ways. So I think it has a lot of interest, especially because the kind of very low launch mass per habitat volume that you have for Venus.
Robert, we're approaching 2 hours. What have we forgotten or omitted, or what did you want to talk about, or what should we have talked about, or what do you want to throw into the mix at this time?
Well, I would have liked to have talked about my astronaut garden on the moon, but we can't talk about everything. But if anybody here is listening and maybe you'd like to go to, it's in the book, what's it called? Moon First, Why Humans on Mars Are Bad for Science. And then it's now said, including Astronaut Garden on the Moon. It's got a whole chapter about, a whole long section of Astronaut Garden on the Moon. A couple of things I wanted to mention, for instance, is, first of all, the lunar soil is actually, it used to be thought to be poisonous because of the heavy metals, but now the recent experiments, not so many years ago, then they tried mixing it up with microbes instead of just hydroponics. And then plants in it, and they found that it's just like Earth's volcanic rock. It's actually a very rich soil, and it's not a problem with heavy metals, because these kind of lock in the heavy metals, and you could actually grow just fine in lunar soil. And the other thing that's very surprising discovery is that it's a bios 3. You need far less area for... You get people talking about how you need an acre per person. You don't. You can manage with 30 square meters per person. You can manage with only 100... watts per square meter, which works out 3 kilowatts per person, even if you're working entirely on LED lighting, using the BIOS 3 and combining with LED lighting, and you're just using the frequencies that light needs for photosynthesis. And then you would have light in at lunar poles, you have light 24/7 year round. And in the caves, very surprising thing that I found that I hadn't realized before, and this goes back to the early 1970s in Russia, they actually experimented with growing plants in simulating the lunar day-night cycle. And they found, the very guard was greatly surprised by this, but things even like dwarf wheat and sedge and things like that, they can actually tolerate the lunar night for 14 days, as long as you cool them down, the roots down to 1 or 2 degrees centigrade, and they will still crop. So they can actually be in complete darkness for 14 days, and then they just continue. The next 14 days, they're growing again. And I was very surprised by that. So there's also quite surprising things in there. There's also the idea of a liquid airlock as a way of making sure that you're continually, not continually losing stuff. So lots of things. I just want to kind of point in the direction of that. We didn't mention to talk about it here, but I think some of the readers here might find a lot of fun in that. I had a lot of fun writing it.
How do we find this book?
Well, oh, now which one was, oh, yes.
The Lunar Gardening book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I could put links in the comment to my books.
Okay.
So if you just wait for that, but if you search for Moon First, Why Humans and Mars Are Bad for Science, if you do search for that, but then it'll come up and you'll find it on Amazon, you go to Amazon, and then if you want to go to the online version, then the head of the Amazon, called My Amazon Book, there's a link to the online version. So that's a version that's free. So, you know, you can go to the free version, or if you convenient for you, you can buy the Kindle book, but you can go straight to the free version from a link at the very head of the Kindle book.
I have one last question for you, Robert, unless a listener wants to call or send something in. Are you personally satisfied at the rate and how we are doing human space flight, or do you think we could be managing this a lot different and be making better progress?
Oh, human space flight. Well,
yeah.
I think the ISS is not really focused on human space flight, especially human factors. I find it absolutely amazing that there have been no tests. I've got a section in this in my OK to Touch Mars, actually, about Tim Peake and the way he actually demonstrated how the astronauts are well aware in the ISS that they can actually spin at 60 RPM without getting nauseous and without anything, just mild dizziness, which is very fast, and they couldn't do that before, after just spinning around in zero gravity. And why has there been no studies of this since Skylab? So I think that demonstrates that we're only looking at zero G, we're not really doing an open-ended kind of looking at human factors, and there's only growing lattices. They've discovered that all that you get gene expression, even with a 10,000th of gravity, that's enough to change expression of all genes in a plant. They're not seriously studying the effects of even microgravity on, you know, of 10,000th of gravity, not zero G, but almost approximating zero G like microgravity, but true, kind of actually true 10,000th of a G or 100th of a G or something like that. Even that much might make a significant difference to plant growing and lunar gravity and plant growing. So people who write about gardening on the moon, they just assume that gardening will be okay in lunar gravity, and it seems very likely, but it hasn't been tested as far as I know. And so all these things about human factors, we're just not doing it. And I think one of the big mistakes with the ISS was making it so that you have to have humans on board all the time. It would cost much less, and I think that the success that when you go to the moon in the 2020s, then I think I argue very strongly that in my OK to Touch Mars, that we shouldn't have no presence in LEO. We should have something like Joe Carroll's idea of some way of researching into human factors in LEO, where it's very easy to go up and down, and you can test the ideas for agriculture and for centrifuges and things that you might use either in L, in the L, whatever, you know, the one that does between us and L1 and L2, that's right. So the things are going to send there, you could test that in LEO first before sending it off there, and you could test lunar gravity for the surface and so on, but do that in LEO as well. So I think that we should not say get rid of the ISS. And actually, the couple of Russian modules I think that are quite new, that those could be the core of a new tiny space station that you would be designed not to be continuously inhabited, and which you could actually do experiments in growing plants and in artificial gravity. And it wouldn't be very expensive at all, because you don't have to have a continuous human suppression. You can actually leave the plants growing there and control them from the Earth, and then just from time to time send humans up there until it's easy to have humans there a long time. So I think we should be doing stuff like that with human factors. And I think at the moment, really, they're only focusing on humans in zero-G, which might be very important, but it might be that this is just a minor matter when it comes to humans in space. We just don't know yet.
And you do have one more question from the audience. Can you stay for it?
Yes, I've got no time in it.
Okay. Larry is in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, I hope I made it before you sign off, David. My question is, there is an awful lot of discussion and publicity around deep space mining, resource utilization, bringing things back to Earth, using them for in space. What is your analysis and take on deep space mining? Do you think there is an economic potential there? Do you think that we could bring things back to Earth and make money with them, or is it only for in-space usage?
Right. Well, I actually think that, after looking about at that, I think the moon is our best bet for if that does happen. So, obviously, the moon has a potential industry of exporting ice to any air and water, but actually has mainly because it has a fixed distance from the Earth. So, you're doing it from asteroids is quite difficult because they're only near Earth for they've only got a few moments in a 10-year, maybe every few 10 years or so, and depending on the asteroid in its orbit, it's close enough for you actually to go visit and return to Earth. So they're quite awkward unless you actually bring your asteroid back to the Earth, the lunar system. So I'm not sure that is going to be actually the competitive one. I think that because the moon is at a fixed distance from the Earth, and it's always available, and then especially because of how it's cislunar tethered system, which is actually, it doesn't get the publicity it deserves, I think. The idea of a tether that can be stationary relative to the Earth, it doesn't require this, relative to the Moon, it doesn't require the strength, it doesn't require unusual materials, it can do it with Kepler, it can do it with materials we have today. And this this can actually be stationary relative to the Moon, and you load it up with stuff, and then stuff goes flying off, he's worked out carefully how it would work. It ends up with this stuff going down to the, being caught in LEO and coming down into an LEO orbit, and the actual movement of material from the moon down to LEO is actually going down the gravitational well. And that's actually part of the whole system. You don't actually need rocket fuel even to keep it going. And the launch mass is far less than for a space elevator. It's considerably quite smaller. And it is something, I can't remember, I got the figures, but it's 15 times, or I can't remember, I don't know why she wants to say it, no, because I've got it in my books, but it's in my case for Moon First, but I actually have the figures, I would just have to look it up. But it's a case of, like, if you're just going back and forth, every week, then within a year, it would actually be worth setting up a Hoyt tether system rather than to go back and forth with rockets. Once you've got your Hoyt tether system there, then essentially there's no delta B at all to transport materials from the Moon down to Earth. And it would go to LEO, and then you could just use aeroshells or balloons, in fact, which would be much lighter, to return materials down to the Earth. If that was the case, then there's the idea that there's quite valuable things on the Moon. I myself are quite convinced by the idea that there is actually, for instance, platinum, gold, and these sorts of things on the Moon, because it must have been impacted by iron meteorite. And there's the Aiken crater, which must have been a core of that body, and probably quite a lot of it stacked over the surface. And there's evidence that this platinum stuff that they wanted to find from asteroids, there's quite good indirect evidence that it's actually there on the surface of the Moon, if you go to the right place. So the experts are looking at that, and they think there's quite good evidence that actually is there. I think Paul Spudis with quite a strong argument for this. And so if that is the case, then the Moon would actually be one of the best places for this rather than an asteroid, because of the possibility of being able to send the materials back. And you could have, you don't need to have the, you would have railroads on the Moon which would be very efficient transport, because it's like magnetic maglev, but with the vacuum is already there. And it's very good for industry, the Moon, because it's got such hard vacuum. So you can actually make your electronics there and so on. So I see the Moon as being, mainly because it's such a fixed distance to the Earth, and because you can have this tether system, which potentially can give you no requirement of fuel at all to get material from the Moon to the Earth. It's actually powered by exports from the Moon, actually power the system, which also would help to bring people from LEO back up to the Moon and any other supplies that come. And so it couldn't be, within
depends how much interest there is in this. They could set up that within a year or two, you know, of a serious kind of commitment to sending humans to the moon. So I don't know, you know, it's obviously ideas, and you don't know how it's actually going to work in practice. There may be things that we can't actually see. But I think of all the cases that I read of, you know, deep space mining, of Mars, this isn't really a commercial case at all, I don't think, for Mars. It's just the export of ideas, and I can't see that working at all as a commercial case. The other things are very implausible. But the case of the moon, I think there's a very strong case for commercial case for that it is possible, if anywhere is possible. So, I mean, I wouldn't say for sure it is possible even from the moon, but I think it's got the very best case of all, in my view, if it is possible.
Do you think we're going back to the moon? Do you think we'll actually see a policy that gets put in place and we'll start putting programs together and timelines to return to the moon? Do you think that's going to happen finally?
Yes, yes. I'm pretty sure it will happen in the mid-20s with the end of the ISS. ESA is very strong on that. And I think also commercial flights, you know, Bigelow want to put habitats on the moon. It's only SpaceX that wants to go to Mars. The other commercial space flights are much more focused companies. I think Bigelow particularly, they want to go to the moon and to Origin. I think they're much more moon-focused than Mars. So I think although SpaceX is putting a lot of it being very vocal, the others are quite quietly very interested in the moon. So commercial flight will probably take us back to the moon. And in any case, we're certainly going to have robotic flight. And China is very interested in going back to the moon. These places that haven't been to the moon before, and you know, China's going to have the first samples from the far side of the moon in a year or two. And we're going to have a lot of, you know, they already had that Chang, whatever it is, thing. I think they've already had that, the first lander. I think we're going to get a lot of interest from China and from Europe and from Russia. And I think we're going to get quite interest. But the first thing we're going to get in the very near future, and I think it's going to be very exciting, and I'm looking forward to it, is when eventually we get the Lunar X Prize winners sending a robot to go up to, because that is, the thing is, that with NASA, don't really take, there's an element in which NASA is not so much with humans, but with actually robots. They don't take risks. They like to do experiments that have been proven to work. And they occasionally do things that are a bit unusual, like the idea that they might send a helicopter with Curiosity to create a 20 little miniature robotic helicopter. So they do these things a little bit, but I think these separate things that aren't organized by any government and they're much more independent and they don't have such a kind of bureaucracy, they tend to be a little bit more innovative. And so I think we might see some quite innovative missions in the form of robotic explorers, which exploring the lunar caves and going over the surface and looking at the ice and stuff like that. So particularly astrobiotics, I think, is particularly promising. They will probably have their first launch in 2018. And I'm very much looking forward to astrobiotics, which plan to explore both the lunar caves and the lunar ice and doing it remotely from Earth. And you're going to be looking at the Apollo sites from a distance as well, so photographing them and, you know, looking at them. And they are very exciting ideas, and they are very keen on, they want to become like the FedEx to the moon. So with a Griffin lander, then they will be sending payloads to the moon for other people at reasonably low cost, flying on a SpaceX, but with a little lander that can land on the moon and take payloads. And they say, you know, this is how much per kilogram it will cost you to go to the moon with us. And then, so they'd actually take a little rover down to the moon. So they'd land on the moon, not just with their rover. They were going to land on the moon with their rover and several competitors at once. And they had the idea of a kind of Grand Prix on the moon with all these little rovers. They all set up at once and see who managed the Google X Prize distance at first. You know, they just use the fastest little race on the moon. And so they're not really so much involved. Although they were always ahead of the lead, with all the prizes for Google X Prize, they're not so focused on really kind of winning a grand prize as sort of actually being a kind of permanent presence in sending rovers and things to the moon. And when it turned out, when Google said that, you know, they pulled out of Google X Prize because they said 2017 is so too soon, they're going to go in 2018. And it turns out that all the people who have tried to send their rovers to the moon in 2017, they're pulling out as well. Well, they're not actually pulling out, but it looks very likely that their schedules are all going to slip, and it might be that there's nobody competing for Google X Prize in 2017. If that happens, I wouldn't be surprised if we have yet another extension of Google X Prize. So it might well be, although I'd love to see it happening in 2017, it might be 2018, that we actually get all these private missions. And it's really, there are quite a few of them. I can't remember three, four, five, I can't remember now, many are still in it. But there are quite a lot of very different ideas of landers on the moon, and that will be the most exciting thing of the moon in the very near future.
I thought they had to launch by the end of 2017 to be eligible for it.
Yes, yes. That is the current situation, and it was spent SpaceIL and actually got a verified contact with SpaceX that was what enabled it to continue with the space with the Lunar X Prize.
But and they've got Rocket Labs in New Zealand is taking one of the contestants, and Vector has a contract for one. So some of the small dedicated launchers are also involved in this. It's not just SpaceX.
Yes, yes, indeed. And one of the best contenders is the Indian one, because Indian rockets, of course, are quite low cost and well developed. But all of these, I was just reading an article recently, that apparently all of these contenders, which looked very promising for 2017, but they all having things slipping in one way or another, that it just is such a huge challenge to get it all together in time to finish by 2017. For instance, the Indian ones, which looks very promising, they're having problems just getting the funds together, even though it's not a huge amount. I can remember it's 10 million or something, 20. It's not a huge, huge amount, but it's quite a lot for a small Indian company to fund. And the SpaceIL, they're having the problem of that there's just a kind of issue of fitting their spacecraft, because they can't afford to commission entire Falcon 9, so they've got to fit theirs in with all the other payload, and there's some issue with just fitting theirs in with the other payload, and they just can't fit it in. And so this is trying to get sort out that problem is delaying them. Just it seems like one of these niggly things that you'd think, how could that be a problem? But apparently it means that they mightn't be able to manage their slot, even though they had actually bought it, but it might be postponed till 2018. And so this article. By the way, I'd just like to mention my Kiss for Moon First Facebook group.
Okay.
If you search on, I can put links to these in the comments.
Put a link in for us too on that too, okay?
Yeah. So if you go there, then you'll find lots of people, myself and other, loads of people there, and some very expert. Like Hop David has been on the show, and he sometimes posts there, and there are lots of other people there who are very expert, who post the latest news and discuss them, and they give their perspectives on. So it's quite a lively little book group, and so I'll put a link to that. What I'm talking about now was the latest post there that I've seen on Google X Prize.
Hey, Robert, I'm on their website, and it says, when are launches happening? And it says Space Israel, Moon
That's
Express,
right.
Synergy Moon, Team Indus, and Hakuto, that's Japan, have all verified launches for 2017. Stay tuned for more news. So they are still representing that they're launching by the end of this year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, they're still saying that. But if you go and look at the details of whether they're going to actually... So Google's... If Google was asked for what they're going to do about it, and they're saying that as far as they know, it's still possible that it will happen by 2017, so there's no reason to change the deadline. But there are people independently commenting on it that are saying, looking, who know the details of all these different missions, and saying, wondering if any of them will actually be able to fly in 2017. So it's too early to say they won't fly. So it's certainly quite possible that one of these things will make it, but they're all having... more difficulties than we expected.
It's going to be an interesting December.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else you want to say? We're 2 hours and 20 minutes into our program.
Oh, wow.
Are you exhausted now?
No, I'm not exhausted at all. Yes, yes. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, any closing comments? Any words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom that you would like to leave us?
Oh, I don't know, no. I just like to mention my lunar, it was just a kind of fun thing that I briefly feel my domestic, it's just the idea of adding the blue sky to the polar spacecraft. Do check that out, I might link to that too.
Okay, yeah, I'll do. Yeah, link to anything you want us to pay attention to, and I'll point to it in the when I do the summary of the show in the morning.
Okay, I'll do that.
Robert, thank you for a stellar 2 hour and 20 minute space show program. I think this is our record. So I've done 3 hour programs, but with you this is the longest one I think we've done. Thank you for being with us, and we will look forward to talking to you again. I'm waiting to do a show on your 1,000-page book, so we'll have to allocate an entire weekend for that. Okay.
I'll let you know when it's finished, and I'll be posting a few articles from it into my when it comes in. When I do that, I'll let you know about it. Yeah.
Thank you, Robert. You have a good evening, and take care. And I'll send you the information when the show is archived in the morning, California time.
Yes, will do. Yes.
All
the best for your time. I'm going to follow the details, but I understand that you're going to have the dental surgery, so all the best for that.
Okay, and we'll stay in touch. And listeners, all of you who called in and emailed, we thank you very much for your show participation and your contribution. Everybody have a great rest of the day and evening, and a good night to Robert. He's, I think, 8 or 9 hours ahead of me this time of year. And we'll be back with Robert Zimmerman tomorrow evening on the Space Show. Good night, everybody, from Robert in the UK and David and the Space Show.